This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You've done it again. You're listening to the West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And sometimes I like to call you Cupcake.
Yeah, you do. It's been a while.
Sometimes I like to call you Cupcake. Is that okay?
Totally.
My name's Hrishikesh Hirway. And today we're talking about The Red Mass from season 4. It's episode 4.
Mm-hmm. It first aired on October 9th, 2002. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. The story is by podcast favorite Eli Addy. And the episode was directed by Vincent Misiano, the brother of Christopher, to whom we recently spoke.
Here's a synopsis from TV Guide. Liberal third-party candidate Howard Stackhouse is becoming a thorn in Bartlett's side, and Amy Gardner is consulting for him. Elsewhere, the Ritchie camp wants as few debates as possible. Leo meets with the Israeli foreign minister about the Sharif matter. A government siege of a house occupied by domestic terrorists is compromised by a sick child in the house. And Josh makes Donna bone up on a self-help guru who's advised Governor Ritchie. No mention of Sam Seaborn's story in this. For me, knowing what's coming, I think this is an interesting episode for Sam. It's subtle.
He's slowly working his way toward welcoming me to the cast.
Yes. I guess it isn't enough to merit a line in the synopsis, but it's really interesting, I think, building on what Sam said about...
I gotta get back in there. That's where it's happening.
This is an interesting little landmark or signpost in the road...
That's right.
In the road to what's to come. In the road...
Close enough.
In the road leading... to what's to come.
While we're on the topic, how many hours did you sleep last night?
On the topic of my lack of ability to articulate.
Right.
I slept for 3.5 hours last night.
You're seeing other people. You're doing other jobs.
I am.
Tell our listeners about it. They'll be excited.
Well, I'm working on a TV show myself for the first time, and it is a crazy schedule. And as I was setting my alarm last night, to get ready to come talk to you, I thought of...
They've been given a 4-hour vacation.
After Donna, Josh, and Toby walk home from 20 hours in America, they've got a 4-hour vacation before they have to get back.
And, right. Last night you had a 3-hour vacation.
Yeah.
And you spent the whole thing sleeping. You slept through it.
I, in fact, set my alarm for 4 hours to give myself 4 hours of sleep.
Do you have alarm anxiety?
I always wake up before my alarm.
I generally do too, but I don't think that I would had I not set the alarm.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's probably true. Yeah, I think you're right.
By the way, actually, I've been hearing stories. We've been triggering our audience, snowflakes that they are.
It's a trigger warning.
Yeah. So I thought I would do one intentionally. Alexa, set a reminder for 12 p.m. Donate to the Radiotopia campaign.
Okay, I'll remind you at noon.
Thanks, Alexa. So it worked on mine. It should work on theirs.
Wow. That's devious.
Yeah. Things are going to get progressively creepier if this works on any level.
So I started to realize, of course, we've heard so many stories about the crazy schedule of working on the West Wing, how you guys had Fratterday and just the long hours. And I don't think it had hit me quite so poignantly how much a lot of the parallels in what the characters are having to do, the lack of sleep, the extended hours, the crazy schedules in the Oval Office might also be a reflection of Aaron pulling from his own life as he's trying to get the show out and just people not sleeping and everybody kind of being pushed to the edge. I guess it's hardly a... It's silly that it's hitting me with this poignancy now, but I think... I've been sitting here dealing with the lack of sleep and all these things from the West Wing keep coming in my head. Monday, I also pulled an all-nighter and I had to get up after going to bed at 6 a.m. and I sat at the edge of the bed.
This is fantastic. I'm loving every minute of this.
Sorry.
Keep going. You're on a roll.
I sat at the edge of the bed and I said,
get dressed now.
And I like the way that Sam says it when he, you know, falls over trying to answer the answering machine. Anyway, so That's what's going on. That's why perhaps my voice sounds a little huskier than usual.
It's working for me, Rishi.
All right. Thank you. In general, this episode of The West Wing has a lot of these moments, as so many of them do, where I feel like they're talking about me, or that the characters are voicing my own thoughts about things in my own life. I'm thinking, first of all, specifically of the moment where Josh says to Donna,
"You know, there comes a day in every man's life, and it's a hard day, but there comes a day when he realizes he's never going to play professional baseball."
You're just having that day today?
Yes.
I think about that line all the time when I start to realize that I am now of an advanced age, such that there are things that I thought that I might do or dabble in or get some experience doing, and I'll never have those things. And of course I'm not going to, but every now and then as I make that realization, I hear Josh's thoughts in my head.
Oh, that's funny. I will in the future. I never tied it to the Josh Lyman quote, but I have that moment all the time because, of course, I live in a land of delusion and I dabble in it as a professional. So I'll see a war movie and think, oh, when am I going to play a soldier? Oh, that's right. I'm 51. I'm never going to play a soldier. That has passed me. Yeah.
Well, what about, I mean, something like The Thin Red Line could happen again. I mean, that had 90,000 actors in it and they were of all sorts of different ages.
Okay. I guess I can play a soldier from afar and it would be the...
Look, we all know you carry your own guns everywhere you go.
There you go. You're very kind. Yeah. I recently wrote to Aaron vis-a-vis the live production of A Few Good Men that is going to be on NBC, I think, in May. You know, how about playing Sam Weinberg?
Kevin Pollak's character from the movie.
Correct. Mark Nelson in the original Broadway production. I understudied it. But of course, this was all many, many years ago, and Sam's not 51.
Right. So did he write back?
I think he didn't address the point directly, which is probably for the best. I like this episode, and I think it's the mostly invisible hand of Eli Addy, because I like the strategizing. I like when we get into multiple moves ahead strategy. And so the political strategy of trying to figure out Stackhouse's intent and surmising that the Ritchie camp is bringing up needle exchange as a way to draw out Stackhouse, which will force Bartlett to address the issue to the advantage of the Ritchie camp. I love that kind of political strategizing. I like, on the other hand, the whole military chess game going on with Kumar bringing in Israel in order to pressure the United States. I just love that kind of thing. I like when the crack political staff is planning ahead. And I think Eli, having so much experience with the real deal, I think he brings that to the show often. And I enjoy these episodes. Like, oh yeah, that's fiendishly clever.
Yeah, and I feel the same way about the debate part of it as well, figuring out what the decision is going to be from the debate committee, and then ultimately coming up with saying, and we'll take yet another disadvantage in the number of debates if we can shoot the moon with a format that we really want.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting seeing the different characters respond differently. And Toby's just got that anxiety about the pressure on a single debate.
What if he has a bad night? It's happened. What if he gets himself into trouble? What if Richie comes after Abby or the kids and the president goes postal? That's what I try to do. Stress, hot lights. What if he has an episode?
It's interesting to see who's more risk averse, who's willing to kind of just go for it, and how it plays out.
Yeah. And this refrain is, again, for me, a classic. His three lines of,
it's a whole other debate. It's a second debate. It's 100% more debates.
It's fantastic. There is a metaphor that doesn't work for me, though. At one point, they're discussing the idea of kind of going for broke on this whole single debate idea.
Isn't this exactly why casinos don't play with a one-deck shoe?
That doesn't really make sense.
Explain that to me, because I don't know what that means.
Well, the reason that casinos don't play blackjack with a single deck shoe, meaning dealing from just one deck, usually when you're playing blackjack, they take seven decks or something like that, shuffle them all, mix them all up together, and then stick it in the shoe, which is the thing that holds all the decks from which the dealer pulls the cards one at a time. You don't play with one deck because it makes it a lot easier for the players to count cards.
Right.
So you have seven decks, much more difficult. In other words, casinos make their money in blackjack because they have a slight advantage over the player. And over time, millions and millions of hands, that advantage is always going to kick in.
What's the advantage they have over the player?
The advantage is just that the odds that the player has to make decisions before they do. So players will bust before the dealer then reveals his whole card. And,
right.
And it is slight. And when you have a slight advantage, you want as many hands as possible.
Right.
You don't want to play a single hand because in that one hand, you know, oh, the player had only a 48% chance of winning, but they won and they played for $8 million and now we don't have a casino anymore.
Right. I know that the house always wins over the long game. I didn't know about the players have to act before the dealer and therefore they're at a slight disadvantage. That's interesting. That's neat.
Yeah. And so, of course, the smartest way to play blackjack, although it doesn't make for a great weekend in Vegas, is to take whatever amount you've decided to risk over the weekend and play a single hand of blackjack.
Right.
That's your best odds of walking. I mean, maybe I'm talking out of my ass. I'm sure that the people will write in and explain why I'm wrong, but that's my understanding.
Right.
Better to play one hand and rather than play over time, in which, of course, the better odds of the casino are going to grind you down. So really what the president is saying, this is why casinos don't play a single hand of blackjack. It's not why they play with a one-deck shoe. They play with a they don't play with a one-deck shoe because it makes it easier for the player to have an advantage, which is being able to count the cards more easily.
The first thing that I thought about and was going to ask you, having no experience playing blackjack of my own, it's called a shoe, the thingy that holds the cards.
Right.
Is that why Dana Whitaker in Sports Night keeps saying shoe money tonight?
Ha! Interesting theory. Never occurred to me before. I think that's pure. No, I think she wants to win money to buy new shoes.
Oh, shoe money tonight.
Yeah. I think it's her version of baby needs a new pair of shoes.
Got it. Speaking of gambling,
sure,
Josh, could you also comment on Leo's poker face?
When do we see Leo's poker face?
Sam asks Leo about Sharif. Leo, everything is clearly weighing on him, and he sort of lets something slip, you know, to Sam in a similar way. He's like,
then you've read that Kumar's reopened the investigation into Abdul Sharif's plane going down.
Yeah, watch. They're going to say Israel had something to do with it.
You think they did?
And at first, Sam thinks that they're just having, you know, a casual discussion about the news and geopolitical happenings. But then Sam starts to, you know, he says,
Leo, we didn't have anything to do with Sharif's plane going down, did we?
And Leo's response, having started the conversation, is to say nothing and not look up.
Look, Leo's a pro, so I take that as his way tacitly to let Sam in on an enormous secret. Whether that's advisable or not, I don't know. But to me, that was just Leo decided to tell him.
I liked how diplomatically Sam then moves on, you know, sort of out of respect for the what he's maybe just been keyed into. He says, sorry, two debates.
Yeah, I like it. I like it very much. To me, it's a conversation happening within the silences of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Back to what you were saying about metaphors.
Metaphor.
There was one moment that I liked. I'm probably reading too much into, but that's what I like to do.
Sure.
I really love this exchange, a throwaway exchange, possibly, but I think is actually a lovely metaphor. Sam comes into Leo's office and he comes from the Margaret side. And Sam says,
what's wrong with the other door?
I don't know. You close it and it's locking by itself. What's up?
And then they just move on. But that idea, you close the door and it locks by itself. I thought, I don't know, my brain exploded with the possibilities of what that statement could mean. You know, the hidden meaning behind something like that about burning bridges, basically.
Hmm.
You close the door and you think, oh, well, I can just go through that door again sometime in the future. But you close it and it's locking by itself.
Nice.
I love that. And I thought it felt apt for things that are happening in this episode as well.
Either that or it's a setup for later when Toby finds the door locked and just steams in through the other door. That's funny. I didn't even remember the moment about that door. I like your interpretation.
Wait, did that happen? Toby tries to the door and it's locked and he goes in through the other door?
There is a scene where there's a little comic payoff because
He
can't get in and then he just immediately
starts
in through the other.
You know, when I had written this part down, I hadn't gotten to that part yet.
No, I like it though. This is the beauty.
It was just a joke for Toby putting something physical in.
You found something deeper and more beautiful.
I do love that scene too. That scene is so great. And this is another fantastic Richard Schiff set of acting choices. When he runs in and he grabs the facts from Margaret. And the way that he says, there are two verbal moments that I wanted to point out from this episode. This is one of them. When he comes in, he says,
given the inability of the two major, do you mind that I'm reading this?
It's fantastic.
The way that he asks, it's not even a question. He's asking a question, but there's no intonation in his voice that is a question at all.
Yeah. Richard's line readings often are counter to what you would expect.
All human logic.
Indeed. Yes. And yet they work. It's Toby.
It's so good. That makes it so much better and funnier. I love it. But right, I would never expect someone to see those words and then deliver them in that way. The other moment I love is when Clark Gregg, in his role as Agent Casper, describes a flashbang to the president.
Because they're going to throw flashbangs. A flashbang's about the size of a grenade, but instead of spraying shrapnel, it makes a deafening sound and releases a flash 7 times brighter than the sun.
It's so intense. I loved it, the way he digs into that. And it also made me think that, God, I wish Clark Gregg had a podcast so I could just listen to him talk.
He's pretty fantastic. And Clark comes out of that NYU Mammoth Atlantic Theater Company School of Acting, where, as we've discussed before, the character is the guy who says these things. And so his approach is kind of a stripped down approach to acting that, when used by really great actors, is intense and draws you in. There's an intensity. He doesn't do a lot, but you want to listen to that guy and you're drawn to what he has to say. And I could absolutely see the sprout of Agent Coulson there and why you would want to stick this guy in every Marvel movie ever made.
Right. There's something, again, about the note that he lands on Sun. You know, he doesn't end the sentence in a place where I would expect someone's voice to go. And it revs up the intensity by the choices he made or the way that he delivered it.
Yeah. I like the scene later in the Oval, too, with Coulson and Casper and Bartlett sort of reveling in their win.
Our guys
are fine.
They are fine. We seized high explosive gunpowder, galvanized steel pipes, time fuses, blasting caps.
And come on, and
blueprints to the pool at KSU.
I got a message on Facebook that I wanted to mention to you. I was contacted by a reporter from Channel 2 News in Israel named Zion Nanus. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly.
Doesn't sound Zion Israeli. Right. Zion Western Wall.
Jeez. I remember one of the very first times we ever hung out, I told you a story involving a friend of mine from school, who, by the way, now makes the homecoming podcast for Gimlet, but at the time was working at McSweeney's. And I mentioned him, you know, in way of the story, and I said something, my friend Eli Horowitz, and you just said, Jewish fella?
I have very keen Judar.
Anyway, this reporter, Zion, wrote to me and wanted to mention something in this episode that I wouldn't have caught myself. The character of the Israeli foreign minister is named Ben Yosef. As in first name Ben, last name Yosef.
The son of Joseph.
And the comment was, that's not really how names work. Mm-hmm. That should be his last name, like David Ben-Gurion or something like that.
I didn't think of that. It's correct, of course.
I'll read from the email. Ben started becoming a common first name for newborns in the 90s. But funny enough, this is the second time that Sorkin has used it as an Israeli first name. I'm still quoting. I think that in the first season when the president scares Zoe about her protection, he says that the Israeli prime minister is Ben Yavin. I can't remember. But in any case, so Ben something is usually, at least at that time, a family name. I think nowadays there are children who are being born with the name Benjamin.
In Israel?
Yeah, but that was really not a trend back then. Or, you know, that was a trend in the 90s, and this character is too old to have been part of that trend.
Well, this is making me think of the sons of Joseph. In the Bible, Joseph has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Every Shabbos, Jews that observe bless their children and wishing that their sons would be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And I've always been told the interpretation is Ephraim and Manasseh got along very well with each other. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm trying to spin out that this is my interpretation is Israel and its neighbors should get along better. And the name Ben Yosef is a little shout out to that. I mean, it's clearly not, but this is my Talmudic interpretation of why Ben Yosef is the name of the Israeli foreign minister.
I like that interpretation.
I also like very much that he produces a crumpled yarmulke from his from his pocket. That's a very nice piece of verisimilitude, as I'm constantly putting on clothes and finding crumpled yarmulkes from old events and things. And often a yarmulke will have information inside it suggesting what bar or bat mitzvah it was from, or what synagogue or what event. And a lot of my clothes are like Jewish archaeological digs.
So at events like those where a yarmulke is provided, do you use those yarmulkes or do you travel with your own?
Usually we'll travel with my own. And B-Y? It is B-Y, but I think it's then the nice thing to do is if you're at a simcha, a celebration, you then wear the one they've provided. My kippah, to end all kippahs though, is a yarmulke that my stand-in on Scandal, Johnny Todd, had made for me, which is a beautiful white yarmulke with the seal of the Office of the Attorney General of the United States.
Wow! That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Did you say your kippah?
Kippah, I guess, is the Hebrew word.
I thought maybe you were talking about, instead of the one, the ad hoc ones that you get at these events, one's a kippah.
This one's a kippah. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. They're just synonyms. Kippah and yarmulke.
Right. There's also beanie.
Sure.
You got three words, really.
A Jewish beanie. Yeah, I guess yarmulke is Yiddish and kippah is Hebrew.
I see.
And beanie is hipster.
Right. On that note, let's take a quick break.
And now back to the show.
I liked the interfaith nature of this episode. I really liked this moment at the Red Mass. They talk about religion and government. And of course, in Israel's government, there's a much different relationship between religion and government.
Right.
And Anthony has this question for Charlie about the separation of church and state. But then in the moment at the Red Mass, I like that Leo, himself a Catholic, is holding the yarmulke and contemplating it. And that was a nice moment.
Yeah, I agree. There is a moment where Amy's planning to go to the Red Mass, and she asks Josh, and he kind of dismisses it, like, no, I'm not going. I was wondering if that's a, I'm not comfortable at Mass Jew. Although you would think that maybe more of Toby than of Josh, but.
Huh. Oh, I took that as I wasn't special enough to get invited.
Oh, well.
That's sort of a, you know, the staff doesn't get to go to that unless they're staffing the president, really, and I don't rank as a guest on my own.
That's more plausible, I think.
Yeah. I really love the awkwardness between the two of them in that exchange. Their dynamic in this episode is so wonderful, both in Stackhouse's office and then in the White House itself. They're kind of at odds with each other and sort of bristling when they're having that meeting in the break room at Stackhouse's office, but there's something more conciliatory and gentle between the two of them, but it's still so awkward.
Yeah, their stuff is great, and the whole professional and personal dynamic between them is interesting and fascinating and makes you kind of root for them, but also understand why maybe it's not going to work. It's very good stuff.
Yeah. And these two moments of trailing off really capture it for me.
Hey. Oh, hey. Hi.
And then when she asks him about the Mass, he says,
No.
No.
I don't know if we've talked about this already. I love the way that Mary Louise Parker, as Amy Gardner, says hello. I don't know that she's done my very favorite way yet. I think it's coming up later in the season, but this is something I think about all the time.
I love that you know this kind of stuff.
I think about it so often because it's the way she says hello, and I say end up saying hello all the time.
And are you saying you consciously emulate it?
I don't think I can do it, so I don't emulate it. But sometimes when Lindsay calls, this is one of those moments, like I said, where I'll be making a West Wing reference and nobody knows, where I'll say hello, somebody will say something, and then I'll say hello, and I'm actually quoting Amy Gardner there.
That is the ultimate inside joke when you're doing it for your own entertainment.
With the word hello.
I respect
of,
that.
Of all things.
The only time I consciously emulate someone else's manner of expression is I stole from Peter Krause, who played somebody on Sports Night. Casey
McCall.
Yes, who played Casey McCall on Sports Night. I used to note that he often said right on, and I admired it because he made it work. And I thought, wow, that's really good. I'm going to start saying right on.
And you do.
That was 18 years ago. And I do still say it. And I think of him every time I say it.
Wow. You've certainly said it to me. You text it, I find, more often than you say it, but you also say it.
I'm sure I'm guilty of overusing it, and I'm sure there are those who would contend that once is more than enough, but I really like it, and I absolutely just cribbed it from him.
I like it.
So thanks, Peter.
You say it when you're excited about something. You don't tend to necessarily be very effusive in moments of great excitement, but I can tell you're excited because you say, right on.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
It might be like my shalom. It means hello, it means goodbye. It means I'm agitated, and it means I'm excited, or I'm sleepy now and I'm ready for bed. It can mean almost anything.
Speaking for a moment again about sports night.
Sure.
Robert Guillaume passed away.
Oh.
That was really sad news to see.
Yeah. I was shocked. And then, of course, I read that I think he was 89, and that's a good run. But I was surprised because I wasn't aware, to my chagrin. I guess I didn't keep up with him enough to know that he was ill or wasn't doing well. I'm happy that a few years ago, Josh Charles and I were texting about this, that we got to see him a few years ago. We did a little Entertainment Weekly reunion photo shoot. And he has meant a lot to me in my career, and I'm glad that I was able to tell him this. I remember it's probably the first day of Sports Night, but I had seen him as a 10-year-old in 1976 in a production of Guys and Dolls on Broadway. I think I've talked about it before on this podcast.
Yeah, I love that story.
And he played Nathan Detroit, which is a character for me that I knew as a 10-year-old, like, that's the part I would play. And I was right. Just so blown away by him. And I was a fan of his, I guess, already at the time, or certainly as I don't know what the chronology is, but he played Benson, who was this super dry, incredibly funny, I guess, butler. And then eventually, you know, in the spinoff, went into politics himself. And I knew from the TV show too, like, that's the kind of acting I wanted. He just was a role model for me, and he was incredibly funny. And then I got to know him, and I got to work with him, and, you know, it was an acting class just being on the same soundstage with him. And he also couldn't have been nicer or more encouraging to me. And when I saw him at the EW photo shoot, this is so sweet, he pulled me aside and he kind of whispered, didn't I tell you you'd do great things?
Oh.
Which I thought was both a stunning overstatement of what I've achieved in my career, but a rather lovely thing to say. It was just so sweet. He was all about everyone else. He was a very generous guy, and nobody was funnier. And actually, I'm glad people were lauding both Aaron and Robert for this. During production of Sports Night, Robert Guillaume suffered a stroke and came back.
And his character, Isaac Jaffe, also suffered a stroke,
right,
and was out of the show, and they just, that was the explanation for the characters.
Right, and he came back having had a stroke, and the character having had a stroke, and I just thought them incredibly bold creatively, and incredibly bold of the writer and the actor to do it, and to do it with such grace and style, and he came back and was as great as ever on the show.
Right, and it became such an interesting aspect of the character. You know, one more shade of such a wonderful three-dimensional character. Sometimes there were little moments in the plot where he was tired, and that was a result of, you know, there were physical things that he could no longer do because of a stroke. It was just woven into the story in this beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved that online, after news of his passing came out, that it felt like instead of a moment of silence, people had a collective moment of Sports Night, where everybody started turning on Sports Night and watched their favorite scene or linked to a clip from YouTube. And it was, I mean, I'm constantly going back to Sports Night anyway, but it was a beautiful thing to just feel like thousands of people were all watching at the same time and thinking of his great work.
That delighted me as well. It was a real tribute to him. And I don't go back to the show and I don't watch it. And I did click on a lot of these clips and did a little deep dive into YouTube that day. And my God, he was great. I mean, I remembered him
really great,
being wonderful. He was another one of those actors in the John Spencer mode who has an ineffable quality to him, that when he's listening to another actor, you still look at him. And when he's doing something as seemingly simple as reading a prepared statement that Isaac Jaffe gives to this, is it Six Southern Gentlemen of Tennessee?
Right. Oh, God, I love that.
And you might think that's easy. Well, he's reading a piece of great writing that Aaron wrote that's up, literally up on a teleprompter because he's on a news show or a sports show. But it's so much more than that. There's something, again, in the simplicity and organic nature of his performance that is riveting and very, very real and moving.
Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful moment from Linda Holmes from NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour where she discussed Isaac, and She said, if you want to watch Sports Night, it's the greatest. You should watch it. But seriously, Isaac is Jed Bartlett, only earlier.
Hmm.
She wrote, like, the presidentness and staffing of Bartlett is Michael Douglas from The American President, but the heart is Isaac. And I thought that was a
very well put.
Yeah, wonderful way to put it. If there is anybody out there listening to this podcast who has not watched Sports Night at this point, please fix that.
And people often ask, and I think the answer is it's available on Hulu.
It is.
And if you need my sign-in information, just shoot me an email. Just kidding. I also thought of Robert today and Isaac Jaffe as I read that the Houston Texans owner, Bob McNair, suggested that, I guess, letting football players do whatever they want during the national anthem would be like letting the inmates run the prison.
Oh, jeez.
And I thought, not the best boss.
God.
Not an Isaac Jaffe.
My no.
God.
That deleted the thought that I had loaded.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Maybe what was a bad place to take it.
The other thing, and I'm sorry to all of our listeners who are impatient for us to just keep talking about the West Wing.
Logan.
This is what happens. This is West Wing adjacent, and so we're going to talk about it. And this is my only time I get with you this week, and I feel like I want all the Josh time I can get.
And damn it, it's our podcast.
True enough. The same day that Robert Guillaume passed away, Fats Domino passed away.
It's classic. It's the domino effect.
Oh, shit. Josh.
I'm not better than that.
Damn you.
What were you saying?
So, Fats Domino and Robert Guillaume, both 89. They passed away on the same day. They were both 89. But I couldn't believe how differently I see them, consider them in my mind in terms of relative age or...
And vitality or...
Something.
Yeah, where in the timeline of your mental timeline you would have put them.
Exactly. Fats Domino exists as a person from the past.
I thought you were going to say in black and white.
Sure.
That's,
yeah.
That's how I literally see it. I see Robert in color.
Yes.
Fats Domino in black and white footage.
All right. Back to the show.
There are a couple rough moments in this episode of male condescension to women bordering on sexual harassment, I think.
Yeah.
Charlie and Emily.
Yep.
They're going to try to give you a whole stack, and right there is where you become a man, Emily.
Should I use sex as a tactic?
If you need to. Hell, even if you just want to.
Oof. It's like, wait a minute. Wait, what? Charlie. Why? Why this scene?
Is it on Charlie for that? Or is it just weird to write a young female character saying that in a professional workspace?
I think it's on both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's inappropriate on multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in front of his little brother, for whom you would hope he's modeling a better example of how to interact with people at work.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say, as you started that sentence, is that there were several moments for me of insane... I thought they could have renamed this episode Swirling Mass, because for me it represented a swirling mass of terrible feelings about the 2016 election.
Ah.
I mean, everything...
Yes, CJ's concern that setting...
The lowering of expectations.
The lowering of expectations, yeah, allowing Richie to just quietly step over them during the debates, yes.
That's the ball game.
If the whole thing is he can't tie his shoelaces and it turns out he can, then that is the ball game.
And I believe he'll have
Yep.
I mean, that is just... It felt like I was watching the future being predicted by the past. You've got a third-party candidate and someone from the establishment saying, no... Those are his votes. He's stealing his votes. And Amy saying, they're not his votes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's crazy about it. It's not his votes. And while she's also right, you also know why Josh feels that
sure.
way.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great little interchange. I like when Aaron writes where you're like, oh, yeah, but, well, also right. On the other hand.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I understand you, Josh, and yet you're also wrong. And yeah, there were so many moments that felt like it was hinting at or just explicitly... depicting things that would later happen between Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump. So that's my, I nominate this episode to be renamed The Swirling Mass of Terrible Feelings.
Yes. My other example of why, guys, is later in the Oval, based on the success of Casper and Company, President Bartlett offers him his choice of daughters.
Mike, pick yourself out a daughter. My oldest is married, but I can have it annulled. The Pope said to do it, I swear to God.
Right, yes.
Oh, Bartlett. Oh, President Bartlett.
Josh, can you do a...
Nope.
1920s kind of...
No, but I'm hoping you can.
Old-timey gangster voice?
Why? What's the line?
Oh, a why guys, see?
Wait, what?
You said, why, guys? And I want you to...
Oh, did I?
you
oh, why, guys? Why? See?
Why not, see?
Courageous cat, Minnie Mouse.
Now, and every time when these moments happen, instead of just feeling awful about the low-level latent sexism in the West Wing, we can do a cute voice and say, oh, why, guys?
See? I'm into it. And I know we just came up with it, or you just came up with it, but can we sell the t-shirt? That's really now every episode my aim is to figure out a new piece of merch.
Yeah, it'll be the name of Single Cell Paramecium's first album.
why did I write down first Monday in October? That's when the Supreme Court convenes for the first time. But
you were going to fact check that?
No, I was going to mention the movie of the same name. But I can't remember what the connection is to this episode.
This is why they're holding the Red Mass. The Red Mass happens before.
is that small detail which has escaped me? Thank you. I remember seeing it when it first came out, and it's about the first female on the Supreme Court, first female justice on the Supreme Court, and I just thought it was interesting. It was scheduled for a February. Guys, why, guys?
Oh, why, guys? Why that month? Why February?
I knew you had that voice in there.
Oh, you know what? It's easier to say than it. I'm going to start using that. Come on, next year.
February.
If you say it in that voice, for some reason, it's much easier.
Excellent.
Wait for the callback 4 months from now. So it was scheduled for a February 1982 release, but Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor in July 81. And so they actually pushed up the opening of the film to August 1981 so that, I guess, the premise of the movie would still land, that there hadn't been a female justice on the Supreme Court yet. And I'm actually curious to rewatch this movie because I remember it as being kind of funny and charming, but it seems not to have been highly rated by any of the
critics.
Yeah, or Rotten Tomatoes. It's on Rotten Tomatoes even. Just, yeah, it seems not to have been that well received. But I remembered as a kid, I was 15, liking that movie, being charmed by it.
I'll check it out.
No, you won't.
I will.
Okay.
What do you mean? Of course I will.
All right.
I'd love this genre of movie. I love courtroom dramas. I love political
courtroom drama
stories. Mm-hmm. The Contender, I love that movie. The Verdict, I love that movie.
Oh, David Mamet, Paul Newman.
It seems like a movie that I would enjoy.
Well, perhaps so. 15-year-old Joshua recommends it to you. I don't know if 51-year-old, 51. Beautiful. Let's end the show here. I don't know whether I would recommend it now, but I'm curious to rewatch myself.
How old is Avi? How old is your son, Avi?
15.
You guys should have a body-switching movie. This is the only year in which it's going to make sense.
That's right.
You have to make that happen.
Are you saying when he's 16, I won't be 61?
It's true.
I can't crunch the math off the top of my head.
It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, according to the 18 again, 81 years old George Burns rule.
Oh, is that the exact premise?
In 18 again... Yeah, George Burns is 81 and his grandson is 18 and they switch bodies and George Burns is suddenly 18 again.
There was a time when multiple body switching movies were made.
And it was an insane time.
Yes.
I feel like this is going to be a time people will tell their millennials about. They'll be like, back in 1988, there were two different body switching movies that came out at the same
time. This was before body switching was a reality.
Right.
I should have tied this into our earlier conversation about stealing other people's verbal leitmotifs, but I found something in this episode that I want to start cycling into perhaps daily usage, which is...
Where's the table?
Right.
I love that. Where's the table? Mm-hmm. In the sit room, like, where are we? What's the thinking? What's the consensus?
Yeah.
What a great phrase.
And it works on multiple levels because you could also use it if you couldn't find a table.
Oh, it's perfect for that. Yeah. Yeah. I'll probably use it mainly for that situation.
Right. But, you know, you have the other one now in your back pocket.
Yeah. It's versatile, that phrase.
Mm-hmm. The other moment that I think that you were winding up to before I diverted you was Josh doing a heavy mansplaining to Donna on A History of Western Philosophy and the West Wing's version of Tony Robbins.
So condescending.
Yeah. It's really almost if someone needed a depiction of what mansplaining is. You know, someone on Twitter, I've heard this phrase mansplaining. I don't know. What does that mean? You know, some potential men's rights activist person or something. And then you could say, here, just watch this scene and you will see Donna knows the answers, but Josh likes to explain them anyway in a condescending way.
Indeed he does. Yeah. Lie mansplaining and lie manspreading are real.
They're real.
As evidenced by the show.
By the way, I just quoted The West Wing, and I don't know if you knew it, but I quoted...
Damn it, what'd you say?
You said, Lyman spreading and Lyman splaining are real. And I said, they're real. And again, I'm not even really the actual quote. The line is, it's real. But I'm quoting CJ in for a future episode, holy Privateers.
Oh, that's a classic. A lot of no, I do know Privateers, though, to my... delight, because it was a lot of fun shooting that episode, and it's one that has a crazy great comic scene and performance by Mary Louise and Allison, and
this is that scene.
I'm looking forward to discussing it. I don't remember that phrase in that scene, but I sure remember that scene.
Is it hazing or is this real? Because if it's a hazing, it's real.
Oh, right.
It's real.
It's real. That's funny. Well, that's we'll talk about it then. That reminds me very much of a moment in Three Amigos, when the Three Amigos, of course, think they've been hired to kind of play out this piece of public theater. Steve Martin gets shot. He thinks accidentally, like, oh, well, the other actor is using real bullets. And he touches his arm. Oh, great. Look at this. And he shows blood. And he has a moment where he realizes, oh, it's real.
This is real. You mean? Yes. They are going to kill us.
Oh, how I love that.
But so you have seen how unconsciously the stuff comes out.
Yes.
You've witnessed it in real time.
Indeed I have. It's real.
In a discussion about the West Wing, I happen to just can't even contain it anyway.
I don't like the whole pronunciation of Immanuel Kant. Kant, Kant, Kant. To me it's Immanuel Kant. And so the whole scene threw me off anyway.
Yeah. Well, I do think of you as sometimes a bit of a pissant.
Fair enough.
And this is just one example of that. I do like Donna's faint towards the conversion when Josh comes back. It's great. I've located the light switch is a great phrase.
Yes.
She's really funny in that whole exchange. The whole scene is great. And Josh gives her no credit for the great joke where he says,
this is an order form to buy owning yourself. Follow up to the worldwide bestseller.
Leasing yourself.
Yeah, great line. He doesn't even pause to give her a hat tip.
Mm-hmm. Also, as Halloween approaches, though it will have passed by the time this episode comes out, I appreciated this line from Donna where she says,
should I go in disguise?
As what?
Somebody who would go to one of these things.
Which reminds me, of course, of all the terrible costumes of, what are you dressed as? I'm dressed as a guy who would come to this Halloween party without a costume or whatever.
Right. I just say, as an adult.
Do you dress up for Halloween?
I do not. I would, given the right circumstances, although I, off the top of my head, can't think of what those circumstances would be.
Being paid to
paid, certainly.
That's a good circumstance.
Yes, that would certainly work. But no, my daughter's in college. My son has no plans to do anything. I will, with delight and eagerness, hope for kids to come to my door, because I love kids and I love seeing their costumes. So I hope I'll be giving out some candy this Halloween, but I have no plans to observe. How about you?
No, I was so excited to move to where I live now because I live in a house and I thought, we'll get trick-or-treaters. I also am excited to just see the costumes and stuff, but no trick-or-treaters come to where I live.
Yeah.
There are a couple blocks further away from where I am is a much fancier part of town, and the houses are much bigger and the streets are wider, and that becomes sort of the destination for all the little children in the surrounding areas to go, and they go up and down, and so we don't get any foot traffic.
Well, I'm in a new house this Halloween, so I'm hopeful. I don't know whether it's a happening, hoppin' Halloween neighborhood, but I'm hopeful.
I thought that perhaps actors, because all actors are the same, as we know.
I will stipulate to that.
That actors would like Halloween more than most because they love dressing up as each other. People assume, you know, turning themselves into other characters. That's what they do.
Yes.
And so here's a chance to determine your own fate in that way and really go wild.
Yes. I think I set myself apart from the herd in many ways from actors. I don't think I have a burning near compulsive desire to draw attention to myself the most do. And so, yeah, sure. I think actors enjoy their Halloween.
I encourage everyone to dress up as Josh for Halloween. It's, again, this is going to be too late. So if you didn't do it, shame on you. And if you did...
If you want to take a quick shot at it now, just in the privacy of your own home and shoot us a picture, please do.
You told me once when I suggested going doing some David Rosen cosplay that all it took was a suit and some old person makeup.
And by the way, if you want to know what the full David Rosen cosplay outfit is, it's a Hugo Boss suit and old age makeup.
That was in episode 7, I believe, of this podcast, if you want to go back. Another thing that I like in this episode is that Ben Yosef doesn't know the difference between Idaho and Iowa.
Sure.
And there was a moment from the past episode that I also really liked. I like when people casually don't know things in The West Wing for a show where everybody knows so much, where Josh Lyman can quote Critique of Practical Reason off the top of his head. I like these moments where people don't know. One of the other moments that I liked, we didn't talk about it in our last episode, but I love this bit where Leo asks Jordan about Sharif's plane going down.
Do you remember last May that a private plane carrying Kumari Defense Minister Abdul Sharif went down near Bermuda and that all the passengers, including Sharif, were dead?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. Well, it happened.
It felt so real that a woman of her intellect and political savvy might miss a story.
Yeah, right.
About...
And then read the paper for a couple of days or something. Yeah, I thought the same thing too. It was refreshing to just admit to your ignorance on a topic.
Especially that kind of a story. It's like, okay, a foreign government's cabinet member died in a plane crash.
Yeah, I missed it.
Yeah. I liked that in that episode. Mm-hmm. I loved the last exchange between the president and Stackhouse and the beautiful piece of storytelling and direction as the president watches him leave the Red Mass. And you see president's there, cameras are on him. He's got the motorcade waiting for him. Stackhouse gives him this very classy response and tells him that he's going to endorse him. And the president watches him as he moves through down the stairs and into the street and then just disappears into the crowd, just blends into the people walking on the street. And I thought that was a beautiful little moment of Stackhouse disappearing.
I agree. I was knocked out by that whole scene and want to give a nod to Vincent Misiano for the way he directed it. That really, to me, that was the gold of this episode, because as he walks away, having conceded what he's conceded, and I like the reaction, just the conversation between the two of them, but then as he walks away, the crowd starts yelling, "Mr. President, Mr. President," and Stackhouse gives a little look to them. They're not calling for him.
They don't notice him.
Senator Stackhouse, they don't notice him at all. He notices them. There's a quick little glance, and he's essentially, he's an older man who has now given up his political relevance. It's just right. The moment really hit me as he walks away, and then the president, on whom all eyes rest, decides he's going to take some questions about needle exchange. It's just kind of an incredibly great coda to this episode, and brilliantly done.
And Howard Stackhouse, played beautifully by George Coda.
I believe it's George Co.
It's George Co.
Yeah, he's a terrific actor. It's an excellent performance.
It was kind of mind-blowing to me the way in which all these things come together at the end, because the president decides to speak about needle exchange. That's one of the issues that Stackhouse wanted to bring up. That's one of the reasons why he thought about running. He was going to address the AMA about it. So he's not going to talk about it. He's not going to run. The president does that. I thought in that moment, in the wake of the conversation about a thing that he spoke about, this 80-20 section, who among the 80 will stand up for the 20, I thought in this moment it was also a representation of the imbalance in power. And here the president is the 80 and Stackhouse is the 20. And so the president takes heed of his own words and says, yes, it is a political calculus by the Ritchie campaign to want to move someone to the left of the president here, and so they shouldn't talk about it. But this man who represents this sort of smaller voice here, it's dear to him, and he's a real statesman. And so he's going to stand up for him and take on the question anyway. And it also felt like an assertion, you know, of the confidence that they have about, say, they're only going to drop it down to just one debate. This idea that this is his moment, and why shrink from the responsibility, the awesome responsibility and power of this job? And he's going to actually go ahead and speak up for that voice.
So that wraps up another, I'm going to say it, fascinating episode of the West Wing Weekly. Thanks for tuning in. You can go to our website, thewestwingweekly.com and donate there. We're looking for people to make a recurring donation if you can. Even if it's a buck. $5 a day? Just kidding. $5 a month even. That would be meaningful to us, and we're trying to get... Even if it's just $1 every 45 minutes.
You kind of went Huckleberry Hound there for a second.
Vocally? What did I do?
And textually.
What do you mean?
$5 a day, $5 a month even.
Stage right even. That's Snagglepuss.
February 29th even.
Or the spirit of, or the Funky Phantom. $5
even.
The Funky Phantom, the spirit of 76, who has the same voice and mannerism as another Hanna-Barbera character.
Fantastic.
Huckleberry Hound. The spirit of 76 even. All right.
Anyways, you can check out the other fantastic story-driven podcasts of Radiotopia at radiotopia.fm.
Thanks so much to Zach McNeese and Margaret Miller for their help, as always, in our post-production process. You can find Josh, me, both of them, and The West Wing Weekly on Twitter. You can find The West Wing Weekly on Facebook, Instagram, and always on our website, thewestwingweekly.com.
And I would like to entreat you to seek out my Facebook page. There's a Joshua Malina Facebook page. I guess it's at Mr. Joshua Malina, because last night somebody at work told me that Facebook pages matter in terms of getting your next job. And I want to have a next job. So I would like you to help me artificially inflate the numbers on my Facebook page, which reminds me, between this Wednesday and next, why don't you listen to a few episodes of Rishi's podcast, Song Exploder? And why don't you check me out Thursday night at 9, 8 central on ABC's Scandal, the final season.
I think people should check out your Facebook page because I have a very special feeling for that Facebook page.
Why is that?
It's where I first reconnected with you. Eventually leading to this podcast in 2012, I saw a tweet from you that someone had retweeted and thought, Josh Malina. And in your Twitter bio at that time, you had a link to your Facebook page.
Huh.
I clicked on the link, saw your Facebook page. There was a button, send a message. I sent a message and I said, do you remember me? I wrote to you many years ago and you wrote back and the rest is history.
The rest is history. The rest is The West Wing Weekly. By the way, people have been asking about transcripts of the show. That project is underway full steam, or has been for a long time, but the uploading of the transcripts themselves. And if you go back and look, I think much of the first season is already up.
The first season is complete.
How about that? That's fantastic. Huge thanks to Evie and Krista, who are doing an amazing job.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.